You're listening to another great Torah class, recorded by TorahAnytime.com.
First of all, thank you very much to the JEC for this opportunity to come and study with you and teach you how to speak English correctly. These are the closing days of the month of Adar, and there's something unique about this month, something unique about every month. So let's see if we can identify what it is and see how deeply we can plumb this theme. You know that many of the early Kabbalistic sources teach us that the body has 12 primary faculties and 12 organs or limbs, and these correspond to the 12 months. Nisan, for example, the month we're about to enter, that's the month of speaking. The faculty of speech is Nisan, that should be pretty obvious. The mitzvah of Nisan, Pesach, is telling the story of the Exodus. Pesach means Pesach, the mouth talks. That's what it is. Nisan is the first month of the year, and we talk about talking. And every month has its unique characteristic. But the month of Adar, the one we're in now, which is the last month of the year, that will give birth to Nisan, the first month, the faculty of this month is laughter. It's laughing. What's called tzchek, laughter. What does that mean? The organ that's connected with this is the spleen. You can think about that for homework. Why is the spleen? What does it mean? What function does it fulfill in the body? It's not a life-sustaining organ. There's a lot to think about. But laughter, as the function or the expression of the month, what does that mean? First of all, why is laughter an essential function of the human? Speaking, we understand, it's our mode of expression. Walking, the various other functions. But laughter is very strange. Why should that be a primary function? What's inherent in the notion of laughter that makes it appropriate for this month, that gives rise to the month of redemption? How do we approach a subject like this? How do you think about such things? So before we actually apply the tools, let's learn the tools. How do you approach a Torah subject of this sort of depth? Most of us are familiar, many people familiar how you approach halachic material. You have to look up the laws of Purim or the laws of Pesach. We could do that. But what tools do you use for the deeper, let's call it the mystical? Are we allowed to talk about Kabbalah at the JEC? If we are, I'm assuming we can. What are the principles? And the principles are always in every area of Jewish thinking, and particularly its deep area of philosophy or mysticism. We always go back to the root. Go back to a source. In physics, we're not looking for the details, we're looking for the rules, the laws. In fact, modern physicists are looking for the grand unifying theory, what they call guts, the grand unifying theory. We go to the root. So how do we apply that? There are many ways we can look at the root. The language, the Hebrew language, is a root. The first time a thing appears in the Torah is always a root. The Torah is always unfolding organically from a moment of conception. In the moment of conception, the whole future is laid down. When the genes of the parents fuse in the child, there's one instant where the whole future is determined, the shape of his nose and his ears and the color of his eyes. You don't see it yet. It takes time in the pregnancy to start manifesting. After birth, you see it manifest more clearly. But any professional studying any subject goes back to the source, to the root. No one serious about anatomy fails to go back to the embryo. And no one studying the embryo fails to go back to the genes. So what is the root here? The concept is that the Torah is projecting itself into reality. The root is the Torah, and the manifest reality is the world. Let's try to understand this so we can apply it. If you like, the Torah is like if you want a medical analogy, the Torah is like genetic material that projects itself into the body. If you know genes, you look at the genes, you'll know this person has blue eyes. You look at the eyes, you know the genes. Either way. Or if that's not your analogy, it works for you. A movie. Let's say you go and watch a movie. Let's say there was a movie kosher enough to go and see. And you went into the movie. What are you watching? At least when I last went to a movie. You're watching light shone through a film. that projects itself on a screen, and there's a one-to-one correspondence. What's on the film is on the screen. What's on the screen is on the film. It must be that way. Our teaching is that the Torah is like a film through which an ineffable, infinite light is shone, and it projects itself on a screen, which is our reality. So every detail in the Torah projects itself into a facet of the world, and every aspect of the world will be found as a root in Torah. But precisely, for example, Hebrew is the only language, as far as I'm aware, in which the word for a word is the same as the word for a thing. The word davar means a word and it means a thing. Why? Because our concept is that every thing in the world is a projected, concretized, crystallized word of Torah. How was the world created? God spoke it into existence. It doesn't mean he gave instructions when he said the word instructing angels or some spiritual forces. It means he said the word and the word concretized into the thing. The davar word is the thing. There's no other language like that. Other languages speak about things. We have conventions. But in Hebrew, the davar is the thing. By the way, this is why it's called a holy language. You know, Hebrew is called Lashon Kodesh, a holy language. The Rambam takes a different line. The Rambam says Hebrew is called a holy language because it's clean. You cannot be vulgar in Hebrew. There are no curses. You cannot swear. You can't be vulgar in Hebrew. You want to talk about naked parts of the body or physiological functions that in other cultures are curses and swear words? They come out like beautiful, euphemistic sort of blessings in Hebrew. If you want to be really vulgar in Hebrew, you have to speak Arabic. But the mystics say that it's called a holy language for another reason, and that is because the words mean what they say. When Abraham walked the earth, Avraham Avinu, he figured out the Torah. He wasn't given the Torah. He looked at the machine and he figured out the blueprint. King Solomon, who lived after the Torah was given, he looked into the Torah and he figured out the world. The Medrash says he planted crops in Jerusalem that don't grow there. He knew the lines of energy, the meridia, that flow from Yerushalayim to every part of the world that they sustain, and on those lines he planted the crops that grow there and they grew here. You know the Torah, you know the world. You know the world, you know the Torah. It's a wonderful principle, by the way. Just as a corollary of this principle, what happens when you study the screen and you want to know the source and you go back and you look on the film and you find it's not there? You study something in the world. You want to know its genetic material, its inner being. You go back in the Torah, you don't find any word. No word in the Torah for that thing. The thing's an illusion. Someone has painted it up on the screen, but it's not genuine. For example, in Hebrew, there's no word for nature. There's no word for nature. Who said that? The word teva is a word of rabbinic origin.
Oh, okay.
You will not find it in Tanakh. In our repository of Hebrew, our concordance, our dictionary, which is the Torah, you won't find that word. You'll find a word meaning to drown. Tava means to drown. It also means to emboss. The sages took that word and they coined it. They used it for nature. Because our concept is there's nothing natural. There's only an emanation of godliness. But we don't see that. We perceive a self-maintaining, self-generating system, so we give it a name. But it's only a name of our perception. Why did they choose that name? Because if you take nature at face value, if you think you're part of it, you drown. Drowning means to become part of the medium. But if you see it as an image embossed by a higher hand, then you get the right idea. And there are many words like that. In Hebrew, there's no word for doubt. Doubt. You cannot say doubt or certainty in Hebrew. The modern Hebrew words, safek and vadai, are words of rabbinic origin. The Jewish people made up those words. God never created anything doubtfully. Show me something that exists doubtfully. Think it either exists or it doesn't. We are confused, so we name our confusion. And then there's a whole list of unkosher words. I mean, those are kosher words that the Jewish people have coined and used. Existence, by the way, there's no Hebrew word for existence. The modern Hebrew term we use is mitziut, the mitzius, mitziut. It means that which emerges from the hidden to the revealed. But it's a word of our coinage. And in modern culture, there are things you cannot say in Hebrew at all. There are no Hebrew words for adventure, etiquette, chivalry, romance, entertainment, fun. Things that our culture moves on. What is adventure? Going out and doing something thrilling and dangerous for the sake of the fact that it's thrilling and dangerous. I mean, what kind of reality is that? What normal person ties a rubber rope to his ankle, then he leaps off a cliff to see how close he can come to becoming part of the scenery? Oh, we have a Hebrew word for that, meshuga. So that's very telling, and it's all part of a system that words in the Torah are projecting themselves into reality. And therefore, here's the key. When you want to understand a phenomenon, you want to understand something in depth, you know you have to first note that there's a spiritual transcendent reality and it manifests in our world. And here's the rule. Everything that Hashem, that God wants you to understand, he gives you a tangible experience of. And everything that he gives you an experience of is here to teach you about something deeper. We're not here to be material beings. That's for the animal world. We're here to live within the material and penetrate, transcend, reach something deeper. Well, how do you do that? We don't have an organ, a sense organ that can grasp or apprehend the spiritual. So we look at the material. And when you look at the world, you can experience, you extrapolate, you project it backwards, and you know the spiritual. The obvious example is perceiving a human being. You never see the soul. You can live intimately with someone for 50 years, you never see them. All you see is the body, but it's good enough. When you watch the nuances of expression and the gestures and every subtle change on the face, you do it accurately and objectively, you get to know the person, even though you never see them. Our sources say that women do this better than men. Women do this better than men. Men get stuck sometimes at the external. Women generally understand what their husbands mean despite what they say. Fortunately for them, unfortunately. Be that as it may. But you take a human being, you see only the external, but you get the feeling, inner awareness of who the person is. And of course, you should look at the world that way. It's how you should look at a tree. When you look at the material world, you should get a feeling for what moves beneath the surface, what lies under the skin. That's how you come to know God. You won't see him directly. You won't see God any more directly than you'll see a human soul. And that's the principle. Everything he wants you to know about him, he doesn't play unfair. He gives you an example. And everything that he gives you an example of is there to teach you a spiritual lesson, even the most trivial things. For example, people get homesick. Believe me, people get homesick. The Gemara says, "Chein ha-makom al yoshevav." The charm of a place is always in the hearts of the people who come from that place, even if they don't come from a particularly beautiful place. And even when they find themselves in another place that is beautiful, something pulls at your heart that's connected to the place you come from. Why? What in the psyche is the reason for that? Why do you long for home? Well, if you're brought up in a Western world, you think it's because a few million years ago when you were a pigeon, you know, you needed to find your way home. But that's not the Jewish way to think. The reason you long for home is because your soul, your neshama, is longing for the place that it comes from. The deepest of longings is for the soul to unite itself with its point of origin. But in the world of your tangible experience, you long for home. By the way, what do people long for when they're home? They long to travel. People like to buy things. People like to think about buying things. People like to go look at the things they buy if they could, even if they can't. Why? Women have a special connection to this too. Why is that? Because the soul longs to move through the world and make genuine acquisitions, relationships, mitzvahs, meaning, whatever you experience, no matter how simple or complex, here's a deep one. There's a thing called dveikus. If you look in Hasidic literature, you see there's an aspiration for dveikus. That means the soul's longing to cleave and bond to Hashem, connect with God in a way so intense that you disappear. And there's not ecstasy like that disappearance. And paradoxically, if you can achieve that neutrality of ego and disappear, you more objectively discover who you are. What's the experience that we are given to explore that? Marriage. It's supposed to be marriage, especially intimacy in marriage. Marriage is supposed to be two people giving themselves to each other so intensely and so fearlessly and so vulnerably that they disappear. And something larger than the sum of the parts is constructed. And paradoxically, when you lose yourself in such a love relationship, you discover more clearly who you are. And what should you do with that newfound sense of identity? Put it right back in. This is a lost art. You can forget about it. But theory. Women at least usually remember what it's supposed to be like. But that's the principle. And we have many early sources talking about the depth of marriage as a godly experience, not a sordid experience. That's the principle. So what we've studied so far is that if you want to understand anything about the spiritual world, you study its manifestation. And if you characterize it accurately, you will know the spiritual source. Well, let's do that with laughter. We laugh. Human beings laugh. What does that mean? What's the spiritual source and meaning of our experience of laughter in the world? Let's do the exercise. Let's analyze our experience. And if we characterize it accurately, we'll understand the spiritual. So let's talk about laughter. That's a very weird thing. Human laughter is a very strange thing. If you look at the literature of this, you'll find the most powerful minds in psychology and in philosophy have analyzed human laughter, and they struggle mightily to understand it. Freud wrote a famous book about laughter, one of his longest works. It's called Der Witz und der Unbewusstsein, the joke and its relation to the subconscious. And Freud fails to understand what it is about the human psyche that makes it necessary to laugh. Evolutionary explanations of laughter are extremely weak. A famous French Jewish philosopher, Henri Bergson, he wrote a famous work, a lengthy essay on the problem of laughter. And many thinkers have tried to analyze their four or five theories about laughter. Very hard to understand. And by the way, laughter is uniquely human. Only humans can laugh, and you can only laugh at something that's human. There's nothing a tree can do that can make you laugh, unless it looks human. Only a distortion of the human, an unexpected feature of the human, when a human looks like an old person looks like a baby looks like an object. But nothing an object, there's nothing a bicycle or a house can do that can make you laugh. That's a remarkable thing. There's something deeply and intrinsically human about our response that's called laughter, this inarticulate outburst of joy. And it only operates in relation to something human. What is the essence of the human experience of laughter? If you analyze it, you'll notice that it's when a process goes in one direction and suddenly and unexpectedly reverses, where it's not what you thought, it's the opposite. For some reason, we have this response called laughter. It doesn't matter if the thing's not funny at all. When you analyze the thing, it's often not funny at all. Here's a very self-conceited, self-inflated, important individual walking down the street. At the moment of his greatest dignity, he slips on a banana peel and falls on his back. Now, if you laugh at that, there's something very immature about you. But even as you run to help him up, you can't hide a smile. It's so ridiculous. What does that mean? Or some politician making this very self-important speech, he doesn't know a small child has pinned a bushy tail to the back of his coat. I mean, how ridiculous can you get? But, and by the way, when you're going through it, it's not funny at all. Not at all. You fail to see the humor entirely. But when you're watching from the side, there's an unexpected, professional comedians know how to draw the process in one direction, and when you least expect it, switch it. That's called hippuch. Hippuch means inversion. And if you have a sensitive ear, you can hear Purim, which is an inversion. V'nahafoich, it was inverted. It went in one direction and turned out to be the opposite. And when you hear a simple story, like the mother who phones Marvin, her son. Marvin, you're driving on the highway? Yes, Mom. I phoned you to tell you that the police said on the radio, you meant to be very careful, there's some crazy fool on the highway driving the wrong way. Marvin says, Mom, there's hundreds of them. It's not what you thought. The essence of humor is the response to an inversion. What does that teach us? And even when the inversion is painful, but yet, those standing on the side, they respond in that way. And laughter has deep physiological correlates. It has effects on the immune system. It's a very deep thing. It's a powerful point of contact between the psyche and the body. The reason is this. The theory is this. It sounds bizarre and strange and difficult, but the ultimate source of laughter is the ultimate source of inversion. And that's dying. Death? How do we know that? Let's think about it. We have an expression. We say we have a custom every Friday night, right? The Jewish husband sings to his wife, Eshes Chayil, the woman of valor. And there's a very peculiar line there. It says, Vatischak leyom acharon, she laughs at the day of death. A woman of spiritual greatness, of deep faith, who understands life, she laughs at the day of death. What does that mean? And why a woman? And why would you sing that on Friday night? But the answer is that, again, this is bizarre and extreme. But in depth, understand it in depth, there's no greater transition than the end of a human life. To us, it looks hopeless, disintegration. Ultimate finality. But a person of spiritual greatness knows that this is the birth of something much larger. You don't see it from here. And not funny when you're going through it. But tisrat yom achron, you know that How do we understand this? A woman who goes through birth experiences this. No, the most famous analogy for this, there's a book called the Gesher HaChaim. It's a book about death and dying, the laws of death and dying. But in the third section of that book, he goes through the spiritual or Kabbalistic aspects of death. And he talks about people standing at a graveside and someone is being buried. And in order to explain that there's a transition happening here beyond our vision, the analogy that's classic he gives is of two twins in the womb. And these twins live in their mother's body in the most idyllic environment. Mi yitneini ki yarchei kedem, it says. Who could give me like those months when I lived in my mother's womb? Ki me'el okai yishmereini, when Hashem surrounded me and guarded me. And as the first twin begins to be born, suddenly this terrible earthquake begins, and the first twin is thrust out into the world. And the twin left behind mourns, because there's no way this child could survive. A child's body has all the features that he needs to keep himself alive in the womb that would kill him outside. So the twin that remains behind mourns for his lost brother. But little does he know that that's where life only begins. That's his analogy. You know, the Rambam, the great Maimonides, who I'm sure you know was a doctor besides being a great rabbi, he was once attacked by a group of neo-Greek thinkers. Listen carefully, this is an amazing debate. These thinkers said to him, "You Jews are wicked to teach that there's resurrection of the dead. You're wicked. Because you Jews have taught us that everything we need to know about the spiritual world we can find from the material world. We said that. Well, let's look at the material world. We never see that anything that dies comes to life. We see in our experience that everything that lives dies. And we never see anything that dies come to life. And you Jews teach us that death leads to life. And you're contradicting your own teaching. And you're wicked to do that. You have a chutzpah to foist that idea on us, when it's completely contradicted by the evidence and by your own principle." I think that's a very cogent question. So the Rambam answered like this. He said, imagine a child abandoned as a baby in the forest. Never sees another human being. He grows up and he comes of age and he stumbles into human society. He walks over to someone, imagine he can communicate. And he says to this person, "Tell me how I came to be. My earliest memories, I was a child in the forest. How did I come to be?" And the fellow says to him, "You began inside the body of another person called a woman, underwater with no air to breathe, with all your anatomy and physiology, the reverse of what it is now. You know, a child in the womb has holes in his heart, the blood flows in the wrong direction, he has blood vessels coming out through his liver, he has a different sort of blood that you wouldn't survive with. One of the biggest blood vessels in his body takes all the blood away from the lungs in the opposite direction. You don't have that blood vessel. He has no lungs. The lungs of a newborn are small, scrunched up nubbins of tissue. He has 20 factors that keep him alive in the womb, any of which would guarantee death when he's born. And you have factors in your body that keep you alive, any of which would guarantee death if you get him to a fetus. He's a complete opposite of what he needs to be in the world. But he's perfect where he is, and then birth begins. There's no way the child can survive. He's born into a world where his body has so many conditions, each of which guaranteed, speaking from personal experience, I've delivered many babies. You deliver the child, and you hold this little newborn in your hands, and you watch him begin to die. First he goes blue, then he goes purple, he makes these terrible gasping movements, he's bleeding like crazy. A newborn child has about 300 cc's of blood, that's all, and he's pouring it out furiously. There's no hope for this child. And as you stand there helplessly, the umbilical cord clamps down like a cord of steel. It stops the bleeding. At exactly the same moment, the holes in the heart close, the blood reverses direction. At exactly the same moment, the blood vessel taking all the blood closes down, the blood hits the lungs. At exactly the same moment, it takes his first breath. And about 3.5 minutes later, it's all reversed and he's doing fine. That must have taken a good few chimpanzees in the trees to get right by accident over evolutionary history, I can assure you. You know, that's amazing. Do you know what the Talmud says? The Talmud puts this whole clumsy discussion into one sentence. The Talmud says, when a baby's born, what's closed opens and what's open closes. Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that beautiful? Perfect description of obstetric anatomy. And not only that, all our sources indicate it's not only the baby looks like he's dying, it's the mother too. The process of labor. Ladies, I don't mean to put you off. You know, it's a wonderful mitzvah. You have to do it. But imagine you're a man and you've never seen birth take place. You have no idea how women give birth. and you're wandering the corridors of your local hospital looking for the accounts department, when you stumble accidentally into the labor ward and you see this going on, you'd call the police. You'd need therapy. I mean, you would never recover. And if you had to go through it yourself, I promise you, you'd never. You'd need permanent therapy. You have two people who look like they're dying. And it turns out that the difficulty itself and the crisis itself generates birth. That's very funny. We're not talking about not funny when you're going through it. And that's why a woman understands this. In her flesh, she's been through that. When we say Vatischak Yom Acharon, we are praising a woman who can go through a death experience with a faith that knows that these pains are generating life. You have to have a little faith. If you think life is only what meets the eye, there's an unmitigated tragedy. But if you know that the pains of life are generating another world. So this man explains to this other fellow, that's how you began. He'd say, you have to be raving. There's no evidence for that, and he'd be wrong. And where would you like evidence of Tchiyas HaMesim, or resurrection of the dead, transition from this world into another, if not in the transition from the previous one to this one? Of course there's evidence in the world. You see it every time a child is born. You see an impossible transition. Doesn't that give you the faith to understand that from here to the next there could also be a transition like that? Why do we sing this on Friday night? Because Friday, when Friday becomes Shabbos, when the Shabbat comes in, you're talking about a premonition of a birth. We know that the Shabbat, the week leading to Shabbos, is a premonition presaging the transition from this world to the next, from the pre-Messianic to the Messianic age. When the Messiah comes, we call it Chevlei Mashiach, the birth pains of Mashiach. And it will be very difficult. All our sources say that just before the Messiah arrives, Mashiach, will be a death experience where all the evidence is contrary to us. When a woman's giving birth, it does not look like looks the opposite for her and the child. And only getting through that generates the result. And therefore, the pre-Messianic age will be an age where the evidence is clearly against us. You know, there's a medrash that says that before the Mashiach arrives, the Arabs will have a building on the site of the temple. Look this up yourself. It's a medrash written at least 1,800 years ago. Centuries before Islam became a religion. There are a number of versions of this medrash. It says that the Bnei Ishmael, will have a building where the temple should stand. Just before the Messianic era, the Jews, whoever they may be, the leaders of the Jews, they say to the Arabs, remove your building, we want to rebuild the temple. The Arabs will say, no, it's our holy site. Sound familiar? How the sages knew that there would be a building there. At that moment of tension, the Arabs say to the Jews, why should we fight? Let's make a divine test. You Jews build an altar and put a sacrifice on. We will do the same. And let's see if fire comes from heaven to accept which one of our offerings. We have total faith, we Arab peoples. We have faith deeper than life itself, in case you hadn't noticed. And therefore, that's what we want. But we want to make a deal with you. If God accepts your offering, we'll follow the Torah. And if he accepts ours, you join our religion, and the Jews agree. And the Medrash says that the Jewish people build an altar, and they put an offering on, and the Arabs build an offering, and fire comes from heaven to accept the Arabs' offering. The birth process looks like the opposite of what it has to be. All that pulls you through is what we call emunah. Emunah means faithfulness. It doesn't mean blind belief. We don't believe in blind belief. Emunah means to be ne'eman, to be loyal, tenacious attachment to what you know, even when evidence is against you. The Arabs turn to the Jews and they say, we had a deal. The Jews say, no. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. There's a terrible battle. Those who survive flee to the desert. And after 40 days of hiding in the desert, the Mashiach arrives. And the Medrash says he goes to Hebron and he wakes up the Avos and he leads them out of the Machpelah. Very beautiful and lengthy Medrash. I once asked Asimcha Wasserman, will it be like that? And he said it will be exactly like that. Meaning the birth process is a process of difficulty, of danger and crisis. And that difficulty, paradoxically, brings life into the world. Black humor, but that's what it is. And so we say, Vatischak Yom Acharon, she can laugh at such a thing. The humor is seeing it, the greatness is seeing it before it happens. Any fool can see it once it's happened. And the Torah speaks about laughter many times. We have Az Yemaleh Yisroik Pinu. The verse says, then our mouth shall be filled with laughter. And the Talmud asks about that verse, what does it teach you? There's an axiom that every verse in the Torah teaches you something practical, not just philosophical information. Like it says, V'yamenu ketzelover, our days are like a passing shadow. Very beautiful poetry. Says the Talmud, forget the poetry, what is it teaching me? Says, you have to make every day count. Each day is a unit and that has to count, make a difference. Okay? So, as yimala yisroel, then our mouth shall be filled with laughter. What does that teach you? So the Gemara says it teaches you you're not allowed to laugh fully in this world now. Not fully. It's inappropriate, it's insensitive. The world has a lot of suffering. You should laugh all the time. In Adar you should laugh more. In Av you should laugh less. But at the maximum of laughter in this phase of history is not complete, not 100%. No matter how joyous the laughter, some reserve. But as Yamalei Sreikpin, then after the tragedy is over and the redemption is manifest, then we laugh. And of course we laugh. The laughter will be the transition. Purim is v'nafoich. Purim means that there was a decree of destruction against the Jewish people that was inevitable. All 127 countries of the known world, and all Jews lived there. In the power of the non-Jewish nations, and there's a decree to kill them on one day. And not so outlandish, the people saying they want to do it right now. Their countries developing nuclear weapons, explicitly saying they intend to kill all the Jews. In one go, possible, why not? And that decree of destruction inverted itself into an acceptance of Torah and a rejuvenation of the Jewish people that introduced the oral law, the phase of the oral law, the greatest rejuvenation and acceptance of Torah ever in the history of the world, gave meaning to the original acceptance of the Torah. That's very funny. Very funny. The Medrash says that Haman prepared a noose for Mordechai, and to make sure that it would fit, he put his head in. And the Medrash says the angel Gabriel came down and said, suits you. And whenever you'd see the Torahs like that, here's Pharaoh sitting on his throne. He's issuing a decree to destroy all the male children. The Midrashim say that he even decreed to destroy the Egyptian boys because his astrologers couldn't tell him if the Redeemer would be Jewish or not because Moses was an Egyptian in some sense too. So here's this king on his throne and he's decreeing that all the children in the kingdom should be destroyed. And on his knee, he's raising the child that will usurp him, that he's trying to destroy. That's very funny. You know that we are named for laughter. We asked the question, why is laughter essential and central to our existence? We named for laughter. The first Jewish child ever born is called Yitzchak. Yitzchak means he shall laugh. Abraham is the one who begins the process, but the first child born into that process is called Yitzchak. He shall laugh. We're not talking about Jewish history being no laughing matter. We're talking about the last laugh. Yitzchak means he shall laugh. And of course, his parents are told they'll have a child when it's impossible. His father's too old, his mother's too old. The Talmud says she could not have a child, she had no womb. Sarah had no womb. Here's a 90-year-old lady with no womb, and God says you'll have a child, and some child. Of course they laughed. Of course his parents laughed. Laughter is the joyous response to the impossibility, impossible inversion. And they named him Laughter. This child's impossible. But the story gets funnier. When he's old enough to get married, God says to his father, great, now kill him. So it's a real comedy. And the Medrash says that Abraham took him and he put him on the altar and he stretched his neck and he took the knife. And what happened? According to Chumash, he survived. The next event in Chumash, he gets married, he founds the Jewish people. The Zohar says he was killed. Because the Medrash says, Ephrosh shel Yitzchak munach levav, the ashes of Isaac remain on the altar. So according to the natural storyline, he's not killed, he survives. According to the mystical storyline, he's killed and dies. Well, which of those is it? Both. Is that possible? No. But that's us. We begin where the impossible ends. We begin where despair ends. And by the way, the real irony is that that death experience that he goes through gives him an eternal lease on life. What happens after that? The Western world spends 4,000 years trying to kill us, and we're the only ones who are still here. That's very funny. The Zohar, Tikkunei Zohar, says Yitzchak spells Ketz Chai. Take the word Yitzchak and break it up. It spells Ketz Chai, death in life. The Kabbalists explain it means Chayas Amesim. That means he lived after having been killed. That's the story. And so we're born from a person who begins in an impossibility. Right? There's no greater inversion than that. That defines the process of the Jewish people. It says, Yosheb Bashamayim Yisak, the one who sits in heaven is laughing. He laughs at history. Again, you need insight and vision to perceive the end, to know that the last laugh is the real laugh. Where else do we see this? You know that, how does Jewish history begin as a group, as a nation? You have the brothers, they sell their brother Joseph, and disaster strikes, right? They make a tragic mistake, they sell him. Year after year, the tragedy deepens, And like all crises, when it gets worse, it gets much worse. When it couldn't possibly get worse, it gets a lot worse. And 22 years later, they're starving, there's no food, and they knew they'd done wrong. But weighing on their shoulders was the guilt of having plunged their father into years of depression, deprived him of his prophecy, and derailed Jewish history, which means world history. And finally, they're starving and there's no food. They go down to Egypt, and some strange tormentor starts torturing them. They don't know it's their brother. It's very funny when you're watching, not when you're going through it. And they don't know that what Joseph is doing is putting them through exactly what they got wrong 22 years before so they can get it right. And finally, there's an illusion of redemption. They're all going back with the food. Everything looks better. And then they hear the hoofbeats behind them, and they arrested. And in Benjamin, Binyamin's sack is the cup. Why? Because 22 years before, they dropped a brother. They betrayed a brother, son of Rachel, Rachel Imenu. And Joseph wants them to get it right, and he's reconstructing exactly the same situation. The evidence will be exactly against Binyamin, another son of Rachel Imenu, and this time against all logic, he wants them to stand by him. Big stakes, the future of the Jewish people, the future of the world, and this time they get it right. Unknown to them, they've just fixed the problem. But to them, it's just total unmitigated torture. And they go back to Egypt, and they stand in front of this peculiar oppressor. And he says to them, fine, he's the culprit, he stays, you can all go. And at that moment, the world collapsed. Because all our sources say that at that moment, there was no hope. They had only two options. They could either go back to Israel and kill their father. If he counted them in the distance and saw that Binyamin wasn't among them, he would have died of grief on the spot. Or they could destroy the whole of Egypt. The Midrash says they were superhuman in strength. Yehuda took a marble block weighing many tons that was Joseph's table, threw it in the air, and crushed it to powder to demonstrate his strength. And he told each of his brothers, you destroy one city, and I'll destroy three, we'll wipe out the whole culture. The options were to become mass murderers or go home and kill their father. After years of suffering, being plunged into total hopeless despair, and there was no way out of it. And in that moment of impossibility, Yehuda, the leader, stepped forward and he said, I don't know what this means. I know we're guilty, but I don't understand what this means, but I know one thing. I promised my father to bring him home. Take me, let him go. And in that moment of sacrifice, of self, that impossible moment where there was no way out and the world had ended, they heard the words, Ani Yosef, I'm Joseph. That is very funny. From at the least possible moment, from the source of the problem, not the cavalry riding in from, you know, you're talking about the source of the problem becomes, at that moment there was an instant realization that every agony they'd been through, they relish now. When a woman holds that newborn in her arms, the pain's not gone, transformed. And she's going through the pains, it's no picnic, I can assure you. But now that she sees that each pain brought the child into the world, she wouldn't give it up for anything. By the way, they were so shocked they couldn't move. The major says they were paralyzed. When they realized what had happened, they stood there absolutely paralyzed. Joseph had to kiss them, he had to hug them, he had to speak Hebrew, he had to show them his circumcision. When you're going through the aversion, it's not funny at all. When you're watching it from the side, it's very funny. When you're being turned inside out, not funny at all. That's the humor of Jewish history. It takes faith. You have to see around corners. What's the practical output? I think the message is that you have to learn to live upside down. The world's going to be inverted. We need to live upside down. Let them laugh. Now, you do your mitzvahs, you're attached to Hashem who can't be seen. You live a spiritual life. They laugh. It's fine. We're interested in the last laugh. When the whole thing's inverted and turned the right way up, you'll be the right way up. I think that's a Jewish vision of history and the future. That's the month of Adar. Adar is laughter. It's the end of the year. God's name is reversed in this month. Every month is a different permutation of the four letters of the divine name. Nisan is the correct order. Adar is the wrong order. Hippuch. There's a month of Hippuch. The height of the month is Purim, where the whole thing, Vanafer, he stood on its head. The pursuer becomes the pursued. Those who are to be destroyed become redeemed only because of the potential destruction. That's the inversion. What comes out of Purim? The oral law, which is all inversion. Ever study the Talmud? You know what it's like? The Talmud convinces you that something's right and then shows you exactly why it's wrong. And out of the deconstruction of the wrong idea, you develop a greater truth. And you perceive more and you see that's wrong too, and you have to turn that upside down as well. Is that what you thought? That's the uniqueness of Jewish humor. They're very serious business. Anyway, those are some thoughts about humor. We take from this month into Nisan, where things are revealed and set right. You only get there if you can turn things on their head. You can only get to the situation of birth, which is the experience of Pesach, the birth of the Jewish people, if you can go through the labor pains before. That's what gives meaning to the inversion. We say, Az Yimale, we say, Vatischak Liyom Acharon, she will laugh at the day of death. Of course, when the laughter begins, they'll be crying first. The Gemara says, before the Mashiach comes, when the Messiah arrives, the first thing that will happen is Jewish families will sit down and cry. Also very strange. When things are fine, you start crying. It's another discussion. You have to invite me again to talk about crying. But that's what people do. People have been missing each other for 25 years, separated by politics, anguished separation. Finally, the train pulls in, they rush into each other's arms, and what do? They start howling. What's the crying for now? The crying is because we go through history with a heart of stone. We couldn't take it if we had a heart of flesh. If you understood one Jewish tragedy, one child tortured 75 years ago, one family destroyed, you'd never sleep again. So we have a heart of stone, and what happens is you forget. The next day is not so bad, and the third day you're having a party. But when the Mashiach arrives, we don't need a heart of stone. It says, "Asiresi mikeves leva even, I will take away from you the heart of stone, and asate lachem lev shel bas, I'll give you a heart of flesh." That's when the crying will begin. And after that has been experienced and expunged, that will give way to the laughter. Let me leave you with shouldn't be too heavy. I didn't come here to upset you. So I'll leave you with a South African story, if I may. In South Africa, there's a character who's, every country has its dumb representative. In South Africa, there's one of those. So the story about him is that he's driving with his friend, and they come to a red light, and he goes straight through the red light. So his friend says to him, "What are you doing? It's dangerous." He says, "No, it's fine. My brother always does." Next red light, accelerates straight through the light. Fella says, "You'll get us killed." "Don't worry. My brother always does this." Third red light, straight through the red light. "Are you going to kill us?" "My brother always does." Fourth light is green. Screams to a halt. Fella says to him, "What are you doing now?" He says, "Not in case my brother's coming through." The message is, we have our own rules of the road. We invert it. And that is what gives us the ability to live through history, through the birth pains of history. But Tishchak, a woman, we have to be a woman in order to give birth, capable of going through those pains, without losing the message. If we do that successfully, we get to a point where we can say, Az Yimala Yisroik Bina, then our mouth shall be filled with laughter. Thank you.
TorahAnytime.com sends cameras out day and night to video and audio record the best Torah classes around. We then make them available to you for free. So what are you waiting for? Watch, listen to, and download lectures on TorahAnytime.com today.